and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of reactions and overreactions to terrorist attacks that often reward the perpetrators by falling into the trap the jihadists set, intended to drive a wedge between Muslims and the West. Dr. John Mueller, the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at Ohio State University and author of Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security, joins us to discuss the latest atrocities in Paris in terms of how the French might react to their so-called 9/11 and the ability of a handful of misfits to capture and hold the attention of the global media as they run amok on the world stage for days on end. Then we will look into the increasing unlikelihood that General David Petraeus will be indicted for passing classified information to his mistress as Senators McCain, Lindsey Graham, and Dianne Feinstein weigh in on his behalf, claiming he has suffered enough. Melvin Goodman, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and author of Failure of Intelligence, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, joins us to discuss the tabloid nature of the affair that ended Petraeus' government career and those coming to his defense while the general suffers with million-dollar consultancies and hundreds of thousands in lecture fees. Then finally, we'll examine the indifference of the Nigerian government and the incompetence of its military facing the growing threat of Boko Haram terrorists who killed thousands of civilians in a northern border town after the Nigerian military garrison had fled. Ambassador John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and author of Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, joins us to discuss rampant corruption that might explain why Nigeria's $5 billion military budget does not reach its soldiers in the field, who are often not paid and are rationed with only 30 bullets to face the well-armed fanatics of Boko Haram. And joining us now is Dr. John Mueller, who is currently the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at Ohio State University. His latest book is Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Mueller.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And do you think that the French will overreact in the same way that the Bush-Cheney administration did? I mean, now that they're calling these atrocities in Paris, France's 9/11, it was pretty clear that Bush and Cheney literally took bin Laden's bait and literally fell right into his playbook and did everything that he warned that the West would do. The Bush administration became the gift that kept on giving as far as bin Laden was concerned. I take it that the French are likely to be a little more nuanced in their response?
Yes, I would certainly think so. We'll have to see. Obviously, emotions are very high, quite understandably, and the big demonstration on Sunday shows how deep they were. But some of that seemed to be a coming together of Muslims and non-Muslims. That's one way to read it, at least. The number of perpetrators, obviously, was extremely small, namely three out of the whole country. And the Muslim community certainly stepped up big time, saying how horrible this was, etc. So it may actually help some. Maybe that's too optimistic, but I think it might well do that. And as far as what the extreme effects of 9/11, which namely wars in the Middle East, I don't think that's very likely for the French. They are contributing a little bit to the to some of the ventures against ISIS in the Middle East. But they're unlikely to open up a new front in any major way. They have contributed to peacekeeping in a couple of places, both in Chad and then in the Central African Republic, and also earlier on in Ivory Coast. So they have been there, but those are small efforts compared to basically small efforts. So I don't think they're likely to overreact in that sense. The main overreaction might well be internally, of just sort of massively advancing and stepping up the intelligence and policing, which may lead to increasing harassment by its very nature of Muslims who are basically innocent, have done nothing. But I'm not too overly worried, as you can tell, about a really massive overreaction by the French.
Well, already, though, apparently there are signs that France's Jewish community considering emigrating to Israel. Many have already done so. Prime Minister Netanyahu essentially gate-crashed the National Unity Rally on Sunday. He was asked by the French leadership not to come, but he showed up, and he's making appeals to the Jewish community that they should go to Israel.
Yeah, there's been, actually, as far as I understand, the immigration to Israel has been really quite small. And Netanyahu either is taking advantage of this to try to encourage more Jews to move there. Though if you want to be safe, it's not particularly clear that Israel is that much safer than France. The protest also may have been very reassuring to many French Jews, realizing how bad anti-Semitism could become and how vicious it could become. So we'll have to see on that. But there has not been a big proclivity of French Jews to immigrate. Some will, presumably, and some have. But I remain reasonably optimistic about that as well. Jewish, non-Jewish relations as well as Arab and non-Arab relations.
But in terms of the intelligence services being criticized, as they are in this case, having so much information on these people and yet not being able to act to prevent these atrocities, the statistics I heard was that it takes 25 French security people to monitor one returning jihadist from Syria.
Yes, there's actually a study in Australia of that that my co-author Mark Stewart, who is Australian, has pointed me to. And the Australians calculated they take about $8 million per year for really intensive surveillance, around-the-clock surveillance of one person. That means if you have like 120 of these surveillances going on, it comes to $1 billion. And the total budget for the FBI in the United States for counterterrorism is $3 billion. So you can see how quickly that basically mounts up. It would be really good to sort of move into that area of discussion, because people should simply get realistic about what the policing problem is. It's not that you can really expect any kind of thing close to perfection. Though the French, in many respects, should be pretty happy, obviously. Their record since 9/11 is a very small number of people, almost all of them in last week, have been killed by Muslim extremists. If that escalates, then obviously they're going to be very concerned. But the record of the French police of keeping things under control has been pretty good. Much of that may be because there isn't very much to police. There aren't really that many people willing to engage in this kind of violence. But you simply can't watch everybody. One of the things they're saying is that, well, these guys were released because they seem to have given up on the jihadist thing. In other words, they may still be radical, but they're not willing to do terrorism, and that's one of the things you have to constantly look at. But a friend of mine, John Horgan, who's been studying this issue for a long time, has written a book called Walking Away from Terrorism. What he finds is that terrorists very frequently, very, very frequently, since you walk away from it after a while, and they don't necessarily change their views. They still may be hostile to foreign policy, or they may feel they've been discriminated against and so forth. But their basic position may be the same, but they don't have any intention anymore of using violence to present their point of view. And that is very common. So in the French, basically, you saw these guys, they've been quiet for 2 years or so or more, and seem to be fairly reasonable. You have to make a judgment call. In this case, obviously, they blew it. The general background of that is that a lot of people are like that, and a lot of the people, they say, okay, this guy's probably clean. He's not going to do anything. We can trust him. Most of the time, the vast majority of time, that proves to be a worthy endeavor. So it should be put in that context. Obviously, you're not going to get them all right every time. But it'd be good to find out exactly how many people have been let out because they seem to be clean and not likely to go back to it and never did. I suspect the proportions are going to be very heavily in that direction.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at The Ohio State University. His latest book is Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. But I think the one thing that we don't have to speculate about, John Mueller, is the extent to which these terrorists capture the world stage. They are able to run amok on the world stage for days on end. The entire global media is focused on them. They get ratings that rival O.J. Simpson's or the death of Princess Diana. They really do get an enormous amount of free publicity.
Yeah, they certainly do. This is very dramatic, obviously, and everybody is playing to it. What bothers me in this is there's virtually nobody saying, everybody's trying to basically make it even bigger, say, well, these guys were tied to ISIS or they're tied to the Al-Qaeda branch in Yemen and so forth. And they're always straining to find these connections all over the place. And when you look at them, they're pretty feeble insofar as there are connections at all. Instead, what it should be looked at is a perfectly reasonable hypothesis. You got an incredibly small number of people who actually were willing to do this. They got a few guns. They did tragically kill several people, a dozen plus people. That's about all there is to it. Now, if we suddenly find there's a million copycat types trying to do this all over the place, particularly in France, then you'd suggest that things have really changed. But I think very likely this is going to be an aberrant event, not a harbinger of anything coming in the future. Obviously, I can't be sure about that, but I suspect that's the case. At any rate, what people should be saying is what I just said, not necessarily because it's true, but because it fits the evidence so far, and you can't dismiss it as an explanation for what's going on. It might be right, it might be wrong, but it should be on the table because it's perfectly plausible and may well turn out to be correct. And it's basically not there. Instead, all the talking heads on television all the weekend were trying to inflate this sort of thing, make these guys into superheroes of an evil sort, and with all these tentacles going out throughout and seeing this massive threat throughout the international environment. And it seems to me it's at least as likely, in fact, I think considerably more likely, that these are small, basically irrelevant or trivial, obviously I don't want to downplay the tragedy of the deaths, but types who basically show that even an incompetent and trivial type person can occasionally do some damage. Though, again, as I stressed before, the total number of people killed in France since 9/11, since 2001, has been really quite small. Obviously, the best number would be zero. But realistically, the numbers of one or two per year, essentially, which is what it averages out to be, as it does in the United States, should be kept in mind that those are really not very big numbers.
Well, when you talk about the talking heads on television, you just can't escape the so-called terrorism experts that pontificate endlessly, and some of them have such appalling reputations. For example, Stephen Emerson on Fox News was the guy that when the Oklahoma City bombing took place, he went on national television and proclaimed with great authority that these were two Jordanian terrorists, and a couple of poor hapless Jordanians got arrested at an airport, and it turned out, of course, to be a homegrown terrorism conducted by Timothy McVeigh and accomplices. And Steve Emerson has gone on Fox News and talked about this incredible threat of Muslims to European society, and went on this rant about Birmingham, England, being a city that is controlled by Muslims and is a no-go at night for good British Christians and citizens who can't go on venture out on their own streets. And of course, it was so absurd that he was actually forced to apologize. But who vets these guys that and occasional gals that go on television and mouth off all of this, these myriads of connections and buzzwords about which I suspect they don't know a damn thing.
Yeah, it's Emerson is an extreme example, one he's been doing it for a long, long time, and has this whole institute in Florida which has been spewing this kind of stuff out. The vetting, I don't know if you can really vet it in advance, but you can vet it afterwards. In other words, what really bothers me a lot as people are making these grand proclamations about things that are happening and going to happen in the future, like the world is going to come to an end because of the terrorists, and they don't happen. And then no one goes back to these people and says, you know, why did you say that? For example, give you an example, Bruce Hoffman is one of the top terrorism experts in the country, by no means a small thinker. He's a sharp guy in many respects. Said that after the election of 2004, there's going to be a whole bunch of terrorism against the United States, that al-Qaeda was just waiting for that period after the election, re-election of George Bush, and it didn't happen. No one went back to him and said, why did you say that? In fact, I wrote somebody, Siobhan Gorman, who was then, who wrote, it would actually quoted him, and I wrote her about 2 years later, saying, why don't you go back to Hoffman and the other people you quoted and say, why did you get it wrong? She said, well, that's really interesting, but we're really interested only in breaking news around here. And so just recently, Mike Rogers, you know, a major member of Congress in this area.
Well, he's the chair. He's the House chair of the Senate Select Intelligence Committee.
Yeah, now he's at
now he's not
CNN.
Right, but he was up until recently.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's got all this intelligence information. So remember when this torture report was going to come out? And he got talked to a bunch of people, and he started spouting out about how there's going to be thousands of people dying if this torture report ever came out. And he said he talked to intelligence people all over the place. And then, of course, nothing happened when the torture report did come out. But no one has gone to him and say, you know, who are you talking to, man? Where'd you get this idea? Don't you think you better go back to those guys and say they didn't know what the hell they're talking about? Nobody really says that. And that's bothered me for a long time. I have on a website, actually, a bunch of predictions of that sort that terrorism experts have made repeatedly since 9/11.
Tell us about this website, because I think a lot of our listeners would like to check out on.
Yeah, it's under terror predictions. Just go to my website at Ohio State, John Mueller at Ohio State University, and on my main page, there's a thing called terrorism predictions. You can go to that.
John Mueller, that's spelled Mueller.
Right, at Ohio State.
At Ohio State.
Political science, anyway. It says terror predictions, and you just take a look at it.
Right.
I actually want to expand that. And if anybody has more predictions that they'd like to send to me, I'd be glad to add them to the collection. I haven't been working on them last year or so, but it's quite a collection of these people getting in all over the world, including Britain, spouting, saying we're going to have an attack over Christmas. It never comes, and no one goes back and says, wait a minute, we didn't have the attack. What were you talking about? The Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, saying things about there's going to be a big attack before the election in 2004, and it's going to be even bigger than 9/11. Nothing happened. No one asked him about it. He later writes his biography, which is called autobiography, which is called Never Again. That episode, strangely enough, is not even there in the autobiography. But the way that experts, so-called, can make these predictions, and then nobody, after the fact, goes back to them and says, why are you so wrong? Means that, and frequently they just get promoted to more stuff, and they keep spouting it.
Mm-hmm.
It's really amazing. Very often, public officials have said that al-Qaeda presents an existential threat to the United States. They're still saying it in many respects. Now they're saying it about ISIS. And no one says, what could you possibly mean, an existential threat? I mean, we're going to cease to exist? We're going to tear up the Bill of Rights because of these guys? We're going to stop eating McDonald's hamburgers? We're never going to go to church again? What are you talking about? How are we going to cease to exist? It'll be just, you know, grassland from sea to shining sea? It's a preposterous proposal. And people just say that. In fact, Michael Chertoff, the head of the Department of Homeland Security for many years, once said that al-Qaeda presents a significant existential threat to the United States, as opposed to all those insignificant existential threats.
Well, John,
it's a natural comedy.
Right, it is. I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Mueller, who is the Woody Hayes Chair of National Security Studies at the Mershon Center for International Security Studies and a professor of both political science and dance at the Ohio State University. His latest book is Terror, Security, and Money, Balancing the Risks, Benefits, and Costs of Homeland Security. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the increasing unlikelihood that General David Petraeus will be indicted for passing classified information to his mistress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Melvin Goodman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
And, Mel, it seems that David Petraeus is probably going to dodge this bullet. I guess it's up to the Attorney General whether or not he'll go ahead and charge David Petraeus with, I guess, what are the charges here in terms of the CIA breaking? Specifically, he's being charged with using his CIA account for and downloading classified information which he shared with his mistress? Is that the...
Well, the serious charge, the felony charge, would be passing classified information to someone without any security clearances whatsoever. There was a CIA director in the 1990s, John Deutsch, who downloaded very sensitive materials, operational materials of all the black ops that the CIA was running on his home computer. He ended up losing his security clearance for a matter of, 6 to 12 months, which means he couldn't get any government contracts. And since he was at MIT, I guess that may have been some financial loss. But I would think Petraeus would be facing more serious charges if Attorney General Eric Holder had the political courage to go ahead. And my guess is he doesn't. He's been sitting on this issue for at least 6 months now. And my guess is it was probably leaked by someone who's rather disgruntled by this classic double standard that we see over and over again in Washington, particularly with the intelligence community and particularly with CIA.
And in the, specifically in the case of General Petraeus, when he was the CIA director for a rather brief tenure that he had, appointed by President Obama, his biographer, Paula Broadwell, he was having an affair with her, and I believe they were emailing each other fairly regularly from the CIA, and he was using his other file for draft files. Or there was some way that I think he thought he was getting around whatever the firewall the CIA have, but apparently he wasn't. But there was a real, I recall at the time, Mel Goodman, there was a real kind of tabloid quality to this whole thing. The reason that the story broke in the first place was one of these Lebanese twins living down in Florida who had hosted parties for the top brass at CENTCOM, you know, giving them lavish meals, etc. She got an email from Paula Broadwell basically saying, keep your hands off my man, meaning Petraeus, who was apparently going to be visiting CENTCOM. And that's how the story got out, allegedly through a zealous local FBI agent down there in Florida.
Well, I think it was the woman in Florida who reported this threatening email, in fact, a series of threatening emails she was getting from Paula Broadwell. And when the FBI looked at it, their first thought was that General Petraeus, who was then director of the CIA, Petraeus, had his email hacked. They went in there totally innocent of what was really going on, but a lot of military people around Petraeus knew that he had known Paula Broadwell. She had come over to Afghanistan. She had started the biography of David Petraeus, I think in the year prior to that. And And even though the rumors suggest that the affair started after he became director of CIA, there was a lot of activity between the two of them in the year or 18 months before he went to CIA. The appointment to CIA was an extremely unpopular one at CIA for a couple of reasons. One, because of his military background, the idea of a four-star general coming to the CIA doesn't go down well at a civilian intelligence agency, even one that has been so militarized in the last 10 years in the war on terror. And also, he came with very strong political views, very strong intelligence views, and started trying to politicize documents that were being prepared, including a very important national intelligence estimate on Afghanistan. And it reminded me of the Vietnam days, because the civilian analysts at the CIA are extremely pessimistic about Afghanistan. And General Petraeus arrived at the CIA in 2011 with a great deal of optimism about how we were doing and what the ultimate outcome would be. So this short tenure was, I think, a great relief to the CIA, and particularly because of this politicization, which was a real worry to a lot of people, particularly in the Directorate of Intelligence.
Again, I'm speaking with Melvin Goodman, who is a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. But this whole story down in Florida with these twins, one of whom was the woman that Paula Broadwell had sent various emails to, warning her to keep her hands off my guy, General Petraeus. The fact that she was having these lavish meals for these generals and perhaps treating them with further treats after dinners would indicate the possibility of some kind of honey trap. Is there anybody looked into the security aspects of how come these women had all these top brass at their place?
Well, that I'll leave for the tabloids. I know nothing about that. I have no real interest in that. I think the whole affair was rather tawdry because there were a series of emails that went back and forth between several general officers and these women in Tampa who were hosting these social functions for the highest-ranking military officers stationed in Florida.
All of whom had jurisdiction over the Middle East, right? I mean, CENTCOM is...
Well, they all had sensitive positions and went back and forth between the Middle East, the Persian Gulf, and Florida. Mm-hmm. My problem here is with the double standard that we see over and over again, that you have an operations officer who I consider a whistleblower, who was the first person at CIA to talk about torture and abuse, and he's serving a 2.5-year jail sentence in Pennsylvania. Whereas you have a CIA director like Leon Panetta, who wrote a memoir that he submitted to a publisher before he ever submitted to the CIA for clearance, and now you have this case of David Petraeus. And when I was teaching at the National War College, the officers that I dealt with who knew General Petraeus had a lot of contempt for him and referred to him as King David because he was such an ego maniac. He gets one kind of treatment. Leon Panetta, as I say, with this memoir that he can publish without getting clearance, gets another kind of treatment. But someone lower down the chain of command, particularly someone who's willing to be critical of the CIA, receives a great deal of hassle and a great deal of pushback when they try to publish. You know, and the best example of the double standard is, of course, that of Jose Rodriguez, who destroyed the torture tapes, 92 different torture tapes that showed the sadistic nature of the torture. The media likes to use the word brutal in discussing CIA torture and abuse. It was way beyond brutal. It was sadistic. That's why those 92 tapes were destroyed. But again, no legal action against Jose Rodriguez, even though he disobeyed a White House order not to destroy the tapes. At least there should have been a charge of obstruction of justice. And he's been allowed to write articles. There was a recent one in the Washington Post denying there was ever torture and abuse, and he's written a book, a memoir, denying that there was torture and abuse. So this double standard is just rotten, particularly in an administration right now, the Obama administration, that's been so aggressive and so zealous in going after legitimate whistleblowers. And the fact that Dianne Feinstein, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, feel so sorry for General Petraeus and that he suffered enough, she has said, and that we should ignore all of this. And Senator John McCain is also now using pressure to move on because he considers him the leading general of our generation. So this the whole business, I think, is rotten. And whether the Obama administration will move on this or not, I'm rather dubious about that. But at least we ought to get a little more enlightenment of what's going on in this particular affair.
Well, it's pretty unlikely that the Obama administration are going to move on it, don't you think, Melvin Goodman, simply because Obama appointed Petraeus. Now, he may have appointed him because there was this amazing tape that surfaced through the Washington Post, through Woodward of the Washington Post, who somehow got hold of this tape of an emissary from the head of Fox News, who was trying literally to recruit from Roger Ailes, an emissary of Roger Ailes of Fox News, the head of Fox News. She went to Afghanistan when Petraeus was still there in his post and told him that Roger Ailes would run his presidential campaign, Rupert Murdoch would finance it, and that they wanted him to run against Obama in his second term. And that they basically said, you know, this is a done deal. All you have to do is sign on the dotted line and don't take the Joint Chiefs job because we want you to run for president. And Petraeus said, well, I'm not really interested in the Joint Chiefs job. I'm more interested in the CIA job. And, you know, it's an amazing tape. And frankly, when I heard that tape, I thought, well, one, I wondered who had recorded it. And two, I assumed that the President Obama knew about this tape and basically said, I got to get this guy inside the tent. Otherwise, if he's out on the street, he's lucky to run against me.
Well, I think it was important to get him out of the political chain of command. But also, I think Obama was obsessed with the idea of having a candidate for the CIA position who would be a unanimous confirmation for him. I don't think Obama wanted the risk of having anyone who would have any pushback in the Senate. There's been so much difficulty getting his people through, and the last thing he wanted was a CIA director who was going to draw a lot of negative attention. So I think he believed that putting Panetta in the Pentagon to replace Bob Gates would be a huge win, and that appointing Petraeus to the CIA, even though he was furthering the militarization of the CIA, which has been a real problem in the last 10 years, particularly with the drone campaign, the drone warfare, and then the number of military officers who were switching careers, going from the Pentagon to the CIA. I think Obama should have been more sensitive to that. But what he wanted from the CIA was someone who would keep the lid on the place. And I think that's all he cared about, that and unanimous confirmation to avoid any political hassle whatsoever. So he thought he got his man, but he didn't.
So I guess you would agree then, Mel Goodman, that it's highly unlikely that Obama is going to move against Petraeus.
I wouldn't expect that. We've seen so much of this, and it goes way back. Look at the Bob Woodward books that rely on very sensitive materials that come from the highest levels of the government. You know, they say that the United States government is a ship of state that leaks from the top. And clearly that's always been the case. And the people who leak from the top never suffer any consequences whatsoever. It's the legitimate whistleblowers, the whistleblowers from national security agencies such as Thomas Drake and William Binney, someone like John Kiriakou, who is in jail. Thomas Drake was facing a life sentence because he was going to be prosecuted on the Espionage Act. This is what we see time and time again. So Eric Holder had a chance to act. He obviously doesn't want to do it. I assume a disgruntled person leaked this story in the first place to force the hand of the administration, but I don't expect any legal action against David Petraeus.
And, of course, David Petraeus is certainly in the case of John McCain, who's championing him along with Lindsey Graham. He's famous for the surge, which John McCain made a big deal about when he was running against Obama. And my understanding that in many ways the surge was a political act as opposed to a military one that essentially got Bush and Cheney off the hook. They didn't know how to get – Iraq had blown up in their faces and they had no idea how to get out of it. And Petraeus came up with the magic bullet.
Well, it was a desperate political act because they were concerned that Baghdad itself could be threatened. The real difference in the Iraq War in this period, 2007-2008, was really the Sunni awakening. It was the Sunni notion that they had had enough in terms of the violence and the terror, and that they were going to have to throw some support to the government in Baghdad to save their own tribal connections. And that's what made the difference, not the surge, which was a very modest complement of force that went into Iraq at that particular time. And also, Petraeus got too much credit for the so-called counterinsurgency manual that he did have something to do with when he was at the Command and Staff College at Leavenworth. This was really an amalgam of all of the previous writings on counterinsurgency. It didn't have new and original thinking in it. But, you know, Petraeus is someone who's gone up to Capitol Hill with his rows and rows of ribbons and his stars on both shoulders, and he has wowed a congressional crowd that has very few military veterans in it, very little military expertise, and is easily dazzled by the kind of horse and pony shows that these military generals can put on. And again, as I mentioned before, Petraeus is someone who's extremely unpopular within the professional and military because of his drive, his ambition. It's so palpable, the lack of modesty, the lack of humility, which is really part of the military culture when you get down to the real culture of the military. So I'm sure there are a lot of people in the military who would be very happy to see Petraeus pursued in terms of an indictment for compromising sensitive information and classified information. But as you say, we're just not going to see it. It's just not going to happen.
Well, ironically, of course, the victim in this, Holly Petraeus, General Petraeus's wife, she's been working in the Obama administration and done extraordinarily good work. She has, for example, led the fight against these horrible predatory payday lenders who set up shop around military bases and get these poor young servicemen and women hooked on 400% interests that the mafia would be even ashamed of charging.
Well, she's probably a victim, and maybe Paula Broadwell herself is a victim. She's living now in total anonymity. David Petraeus is now a limited partner in one of the largest equity firms in the United States. He's on a very lucrative lecture tour around the country. He's beefing up his bank accounts. You know, again, for Senator Feinstein to say he's suffered enough, well, any more suffering like this, and the guy's going to be a multi-billionaire at the rate that he's suffering. So our attention really is going at the wrong people, and not the people who've really, I think, suffered as a consequence of this guy's irresponsibility. But passing classified information only to make himself look good, because that's what this was all about, it wasn't really to tell a story. It was to burnish his own credentials with this fawning biography that Paula Broadwell was responsible for. It's a pretty sad and tawdry chapter in civilian-military relations.
Well, just in closing, Mel Goodman, what do you make of the Obama administration's appointment of a Treasury Department official in the number two job at the CIA? Is that a recognition that nowadays, in many ways, the Treasury has more power and influence in global affairs than perhaps even the Pentagon does with all of its carrier battle groups and nuclear weapons?
I don't think it's a reflection of the power of the Treasury so much as it's a reflection of the decline and fall of the CIA. One of the real problems that the CIA has, if you look at the Senate report on torture and abuse, and of course we've only seen the executive summary, but that is 600 pages, and I've read most of them, and you can tell from the redactions that there must be a couple hundred people who were implicated in the torture and abuse who are now holding positions at the CIA. And I assume a lot of these people would be in senior management and senior leadership. So I think what Obama is saying, and CIA Director John Brennan perhaps agrees, that they don't want to take the chance on naming someone who would have very tarnished credentials, who would become a problem in facing confirmation. This is not something, well, it wouldn't be confirmation so much as the publicity that it would get if one of these tarnished individuals was named to be the deputy director of the CIA. So I think it's more a reflection of the decline of the CIA than it is the rise and stature of the Treasury Department. Also, this is an individual who has very high marks for the economic operations and the economic coercion programs that he's been operating. He's incredibly skillful. He's obviously extremely bright, real quick study, whip smart. And the CIA needs someone like this. And he's replacing someone who was also an outsider, too, who came from the National Security Council and will go back to the National Security Council. So, again, it tells you that the CIA is lacking the people who could occupy these senior positions. So it does reflect their decline and fall over recent years.
In spite of the enormous extra amounts of money they've been getting.
Record-breaking, unprecedented in terms of the amount of money they have, particularly in relation to other intelligence agencies. And it's the fact that they are part of the war fighting. These are now warriors. The drone campaign is a massive campaign, and when you look at their paramilitary activities across the board, this has really led to a huge increase in CIA spending that needs to be gotten under control.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Melvin Goodman.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Melvin Goodman, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a professor of government at Johns Hopkins University. His 42-year government career included service at the CIA, State Department, Defense Department, and the U.S. Army. And his latest book is National Insecurity, The Cost of American Militarism. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into why the Nigerian government and military can't combat Boko Haram.
Someone nearly died. Hey, someone just died. Hey, police, they come, army, they come. Hey, confusion everywhere. Hey, 7 minutes later, all done cool down, brother. Police don't go away. Army don't disappear. Them leave sorrow, tears, and blood.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ambassador John Campbell, who is the Ralph Bunch Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a career Foreign Service officer and the former U.S. Ambassador to Nigeria. He was a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections, and his latest book is Nigeria Dancing on the Brink, now in its second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador John Campbell.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you.
And in terms of dancing on the brink, Nigeria, it's very puzzling for people to understand why it is that this insurgency of Boko Haram in the north of the country can't be contained, and atrocity after atrocity hits the headlines. And the latest one, of course, was the massacre of a town from which the Nigerian military garrison fled and left the unfortunate civilian population to be massacred. Is there an answer to that looming question? What is wrong with the Nigerian military and the Nigerian government?
Let's focus first on the shortcomings of the Nigerian military. It is perfectly true that Nigeria had military governments for more than 30 years. Nevertheless, the Nigerian military has been underfunded at least since 1990. That's some 25 years ago, in part as of an effort by successive governments to forestall military coups. A consequence of that is that the Nigerian military, which when I was ambassador was said to consist of some 60 to 70,000, now some observers think may be as small as 25 or 30,000. That is to say 25 or 30,000 who are equipped, trained, and ready to fight. That's not very many. But there are other aspects of this that are puzzling. The Nigerian defense budget is somewhere between $5 and $6 billion. Yet, there are reports that Nigerian soldiers are sent into firefights with Boko Haram with only 30 bullets. And when they use up the bullets, they run away. With a defense budget of $5 to $6 billion, where is the money going? It's all very unclear.
That's an extraordinary statistic, because if you only have basically one division of military and $5 billion, that's the most lavish, you know, manpower spending in history.
Well, and now perhaps less so when you consider that for budgetary purposes, it includes institutions like the State Security Service and also the police. The police in Nigeria are a national body. However, the police are not known for being well-trained or being well-disciplined.
So is the government of Goodluck Jonathan then concerned about military coups and starving the military while somebody is clearly collecting on the $5 billion budget? So does this
It's hard to know. It's hard to know because the upper reaches of the Nigerian military have been progressively politicized so that the top officers in the military are people who are essentially politically allied with Jonathan. What Nigerians are terrified of, and in fact don't even like to talk about it, is the possibility of a junior officer coup. A junior officer coup would, as it were, come out of the blue, would probably start as a mutiny, and would be quite bloody. Something along the lines of what Flight Lieutenant Rawlings pulled off in Ghana more than 20 years ago.
So a lot of critics have accused the Goodluck Jonathan government of not doing enough to direct the insurgency. And I'm talking about its domestic critics. And one of the explanations I've heard is that the area in the north where Boko Haram is active and have conducted these mass kidnappings and murders and are in the hands of the opposition party. So are domestic politics a factor here?
They probably are, though it's hard to parse it out. The general part of Nigeria that you're talking about traditionally opposes whatever government is in Abuja. And, in fact, insofar as we can tell, it would be, if you could have elections in that part of the country on February 14th, 2015, now only about a month away, voters would probably tend to support the opposition party.
But this is clearly not going to happen, right? If the military run away when Boko Haram show up, I can't imagine the polling people and the election people are going to be able to go in there. So what is the...
Well, frankly, neither. I can't imagine it either. And I think we should anticipate that Boko Haram will do everything it can to disrupt any polling.
So at some point or other, what happens here to the Nigerian military? I mean, do they have a sense of shame, or, you know, is there other civilians, the people complaining about them? Or, I mean, one would think that the people that they're not defending would be extremely unhappy with the National Army.
It's a very interesting question. When I first served in Nigeria back in the 1980s, the military was seen as the ultimate guarantor of the state. The military was not particularly associated with specific religious or ethnic groups. It was a genuinely national institution. Some maintained it was the only genuinely national institution. However, that is clearly eroded. And one senior Nigerian general said to me some months ago that, in fact, the same divisions, stresses, and strains that you find in Nigerian society now are also present in the military.
Well, we spoke a while back, Ambassador Campbell, at the time that the former finance minister, or the, I think it was actually the head of the central bank, quit in protest, or was actually fired by the Goodluck Jonathan government because he had asked questions about some $30 billion in oil revenue that simply went missing?
This is correct. This was the governor of the central bank, Lamido Sanusi, who is now the emir of Kano. And what he said was either $10 billion or $20 billion or $50 billion had not been transferred from the National Petroleum Company to the Treasury. In response, the finance minister has ordered an audit, but the results of that audit, either the audit is not complete, or if it is, the results of the audit have not been made public.
So this is a calamitous situation for any country. And again, I get back to the apparent nonchalance of the government of Goodluck Jonathan. I mean,
not just of the government. It is quite astonishing how if you talk to Nigerians who are involved in the modern aspects of the economy, particularly based in Lagos and Ibadan, which is some 800 or 900 miles away, from Borno, the sort of unconcern or lack of interest is really quite astonishing. The Jonathan government tends to reflect that.
So what would you attribute that to then, Ambassador Campbell?
The roots of it are clearly very deep. In the south, northeastern Nigeria has very often been marginalized. It's a long way away. Its social statistics are by far the worst in the country. It is extremely poor. It's one of the poorest predominantly Muslim areas in the world. And it's simply not very relevant. If you are deeply involved in petrochemicals, real estate, and IT, all based in Lagos.
So would then the government of Chad be more on the ball? They must be threatened as well.
Well, but not much, because Boko Haram doesn't seem to have extensive extraterritorial ambitions. It looks like it would like to incorporate certain small border areas in Niger, Chad, and Cameroon into this caliphate that it wants to create in northeastern Nigeria. But it does not seem to be expansive in the way that, say, Al-Qaeda is.
So my understanding is that the Pentagon recently refused to send arms to the Nigerian government to help them fight Boko Haram?
No. The story is more complicated and also more interesting. The Nigerians wish to purchase helicopters from the Israelis. The Israelis had purchased the helicopters from the United States, and to transfer them would require U.S. permission. This is a standard kind of provision of arms sales. The U.S. declined to approve the transfer on the basis that it would take a year to train the helicopter pilots. And it did not seem that these helicopters were particularly appropriate for what the mission might be.
So at this point, then, what are military-to-military relations? Is Goodluck Jonathan asking for American help?
No.
So is he asking for anybody else's help?
No.
So what is likely to happen here, then? The 8th Division is in that area. They're supposed to have 8,500 troops deployed, but nothing seems to be happening except the soldiers are running away.
Well, that's right. Now, what the official line is that Boko Haram will be defeated and that elections on February 14th will proceed.
Does anybody believe that? Or, I mean,
well, I don't.
Well, I find this extraordinary. Notwithstanding that perhaps we do sometimes overreact to terrorist acts, and obviously what we just saw in Paris was an attempt by terrorist groups to drive a wedge between Muslims and the West, and that's something obviously to resist. But in this case, this is a bloody insurgency under the banner, I believe, of Boko Haram, which means what? Those opposed to Western education?
Yes, it does. A way to think about Boko Haram is that, amongst other things, it's a civil war inside Nigerian Islam, a civil war between those like Boko Haram who are bitterly opposed to the secular state. They're bitterly opposed to the secular state because they see a secular state as putting itself in place of Allah. And then there is, as it were, what has been the traditional mainstream northern Nigerian Islam, which was broadly tolerant, strongly influenced by Sufi mysticism, and quite willingly participated in the secular state. Jonathan's principal opponent in the upcoming presidential elections is Muhammadu Buhari, a former military ruler of Nigeria, who is a practicing Muslim.
Of the Sufis?
Yes, that's right.
Mader.
And there was an effort to assassinate him a few months ago.
Mm-hmm. So then we're talking about a struggle within Islam, which is manifest in other countries, particularly in Pakistan, where the radicals go after the Sufis and have driven them out of the state of Swat. This seems to be a pattern, and certainly the jihadists and the Salafists, their first target are the Sufis. So
I would say there's similarities, but we have to be careful because in both cases, they're very much framed by country-specific factors. In other words, the Sufism practiced in northern Nigeria is similar to, but not exactly the same, as the Sufism that you might find in Pakistan.
So just in closing then, Ambassador Campbell, the fact that 54 Nigerian soldiers have been sentenced to death for mutiny and cowardice for refusing to fight Boko Haram, is that simply the government scapegoating soldiers as opposed to taking responsibilities for their own failures?
In my view, yes. And if you're talking about about morale, I can imagine nothing more destructive than shooting 50-odd soldiers who claim, at least, that they refused to follow orders because they didn't have any ammunition.
Well, Ambassador Campbell, I thank you very much for joining us here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Ambassador John Campbell, who's the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a career Foreign Service officer and a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria. He was a political counselor at the U.S. Embassy in Pretoria during South Africa's first non-racial elections. And his latest book is Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, now in its second edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.